This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the city of Goma, which sits right on this vast country's eastern border next to Rwanda. It is a vital hub, commercially and strategically, and a major prize for the group of rebels known as M23, who've been edging ever closer to capturing it over the past few days. It's also home to nearly 2 million people, perhaps half a million of which are people who fled the fighting as the rebels advanced. They're now caught up in the thick of it once again, with conditions in Goma deteriorating fast. A meeting between the presidents of Congo and Rwanda, which backs the rebels, was meant to take place today in Kenya, but now looks like it's off, despite growing international calls for a ceasefire. Shortly before we came on the air, I spoke to Vivian van der Peer, who's in Goma. She is deputy head of the UN Stabilisation Mission in the DRC. And I asked her, who controls Goma right now?
That would be the M23.
And so they're completely in control of the city, do you think?
Completely is a big word. They control the city. They have roadblocks everywhere, but there are pockets of resistance and fighting, and there's many elements still roaming. So I wouldn't call it complete control, but they definitely have established themselves in Goma.
And what about the airport? Is that in M23 hands too, do you know?
It is my understanding that the airport is in M23 hands right now, but I have not been able to go there, so I have not independently verified that. But from the troops that we have around the airport, the M23 seems to be controlling the airport.
And if that is the case, what are the implications for delivery of humanitarian aid in the days to come?
That is a big hindrance, indeed. So we need the airport to be reopened as soon as possible by whoever controls it, so that we can establish air bridges with the outside world in order to get humanitarian aid that is desperately needed into this region.
Well, I was going to ask you, how bad is the situation? What do people need right now?
They need absolutely everything. First of all, they need safety and security. We've had a couple of days of heavy fighting between M23 and the government and its allies. Fortunately, that has largely calmed down now. As I described, there's some pockets of fighting here and there. But the M23, as I understand it, is trying to establish themselves here as the, if I can call it, de facto authorities, and they would be, since they are in control at the moment and it's just a reality, they would be responsible for reestablishing safety and security. So that's one. Secondly, humanitarian needs are tremendous. The population is suffering tremendously. They need food, water, medical care, everything. The electricity has been down. The Wi-Fi has been down. Water is in very short supply. Even our own troops in MINUSCO, we are running low on supplies, and some bases have run out because many of the population have been coming to seek refuge in our bases, including, by the way, surrendering armed elements that have entered our bases without weapons, of course.
And sorry, on that, do you mean Congolese troops are sheltering in UN bases?
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to tell because they also had a lot of allies. So there's also various armed elements that cannot be clearly identified because we allow people on our base only if they're disarmed, no arms allowed, and also no uniforms. So it's kind of hard to tell, but one can assume that there's large numbers of the Congolese coalition among them.
Yeah, there were some reports of 1,000 Romanian mercenaries also sheltering. Have you heard about that or seen that?
I've heard about that, and they have managed to leave the country, so they're no longer present in the Congo, as I understand it.
Have you had any direct contact yourself with the rebels?
Necessarily, we need to coordinate on certain very urgent issues, such as the movement of our troops, our freedom of movement. We are doing our utmost to play a role in the protection of civilians, regardless of who controls the area. So, yes, I have coordinated with them on our freedom of movement, and we are trying to establish some kind of working relationship right now, in order to benefit the population. So they claim that they want the best for the population. So if I take them on their word, then I am going to use that to make sure that MONUSCO is allowed to go out and to help the population where it can.
So the UN troops, are they at the moment just confined to barracks, if you like, or are they able to go out at all?
They have now starting to get around since this morning, and that's the result of the technical coordination that I talked to you about. We are able to get around, which was extremely urgent because some of our bases had run out of food and water and are literally sheltering thousands of people. So they have allowed us, if I can use that word, it's a loaded word, but they have allowed us to go and resupply those bases so that we can take care of all the people that find themselves in there.
There have been a number of UN reports talking about, 3,000 to 4,000 Rwandan armed troops fighting with the rebels. Have you got any personal confirmation of that? Have you seen that for yourself in Goma?
We have been locked down. I'm in the Goma headquarters here, so we've been locked down in the bunkers. Our bases were being heavily affected by crossfire, RPGs, mortars, so we have been spending most of our time in the bunkers. So I have not been going around, but I've seen the pictures on the social media indeed.
And what about the dangers of ethnic conflict breaking out? Obviously a very sensitive issue in this part of the world. Could the fighting exacerbate those ethnic tensions in your view?
I hope it will not. We have seen some indications of ethnic tensions being on the rise, and this is everybody's worst nightmare because we all know that this region of the Congo has always been suffering from ethnic tensions, and particularly after the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, and some of this is still a tail end of that. So we are very vigilant to look out for signs of that, and we call upon all the parties to just have the best of the population at heart, regardless of their ethnicity.
Is it possible, though, that the rebels and their Rwandan backers don't just want Goma, that they want to move on to elsewhere in the country, even head to Kinshasa? The Rebel Alliance is led by a man who said, our objective is Kinshasa, the source of all the problems. Is this a sort of local conflict that's going to explode into something much, much bigger?
Well, that is the fear that everybody has. We cannot predict how this will go. The M23 itself seems to have more a localized objective. They are a Congolese armed group, and they are limited to the east, but they are backed by their political allies, the Alliance Fleuve Congo, and they have stated this goal. At this moment, it's impossible to predict what the next steps will be, but that would be the worst case scenario.
That was Vivian van der Perre, deputy head of the UN mission in the DRC, speaking to us from Goma. Let's talk to the journalist and writer Michaela Rong, who's very knowledgeable about the DRC and Rwanda. She's worked for the Financial Times and Reuters and has written a book on Rwanda. She joins us live. Michaela, thanks very much for being with us here today. And reports coming in now that the rebels are advancing on another important city. So is it safe to assume that Goma isn't the end game here?
Well, I think everyone was expecting this. What we're hearing, and it's been reported by Reuters, is that the M23 is now heading south, heading towards Bukavu, which is the capital of South Kivu. And it was always obvious that if the M23 took Goma, they would also want Bukavu. They're at two ends of Lake Kivu. It has an airport, just like Goma. It's on a major trading route between Congo and Rwanda. And so if you grab one, you're going to grab the other.
What is the bigger picture? What's the goal, do you think, of this offensive?
Well, I think this has been the question now for the last three years that the M23 has been active. People have been saying, is this just Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, sort of rattling Congo's cage, bringing home to everyone the fact that he's the guy who gets to decide what's going on in the Great Lakes. He's a very macho, very domineering character. But I think as time has gone by, increasingly people have seen this as a bit of a rerun, that we're in Groundhog Day and that we're back to the era in the late 1990s where a series of officially Congolese rebel groups, but really backed to the hilt by Rwanda, just went, at will into Congo and had their eyes on Congo's mineral riches, but also at various key moments attempted to topple the leadership of what was then Zaire.
We have been here before, a decade or more ago, at least with Goma, but the rebels in Rwanda backed down. Can pressure be brought to bear this time, or is it different, do you think?
Well, I think what's different is that there hasn't been any willingness on the part of the international community to apply real pressure. There's been endless statements from the UN, from the US, from the UK, from France, decrying Rwandan support for the M23 advances, Kigali's role in all of this. And back in 2012, though, that was backed up with a major aid freeze, $240 million worth of aid that went regularly to Rwanda was just cut overnight. And then suddenly the M23 stopped being a problem and the rebels that were involved in it dispersed and returned to Rwanda and Uganda. This has not happened this time. And it's for a reason of self-serving interests of the players, the Western donors that are involved. And I think they're going to come to rue the day. And even now, we had an emergency meeting. The UN Security Council met on Sunday. We've got another meeting coming up. And yet all we've seen so far is Germany issuing a statement that they have suspended talks with Rwanda on aid. That's not going to be enough to deter Kagame. We have to see something more forceful.
I think we'll have to leave it there because it's dipping in and out. But Michaela, thank you very much indeed. Michaela Rong, journalist and writer on the DRC and Rwanda. There is, of course, much more on this story on our website. All the latest, plus a bit more on the background to Rwanda's support for those M23 rebels as they advance through Goma, and as we were hearing, onto that next city, Bukavu, on the other end of Lake Kivu. It's all at bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. Let's head to northern India because a large number of people are reported to have been killed or injured in a crush at what is the world's largest religious festival. The Kumbh Mela takes place every 12 years at the confluence of the Ganges and Yamuna rivers and attracts tens of millions of Hindu pilgrims who come to bathe in the sacred waters. Eyewitnesses said pilgrims rushing to take part in a day of ritual bathing trampled over people sleeping on the banks of the Ganges.
12 baje raat mein hum 7 aadmi the usme se
7 of us from my family were together around midnight. 3 of them are asthmatic. When the crush happened, we all fell down. Others fell on top of us. I've lost my phone and all my money. Now I don't know where the rest of my family is.
Well, our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain is also there and has been telling me more about what happened earlier today.
There are literally millions of people that have come to this festival, and there are thousands of them just sleeping right along the riverbanks. And it's because they want to be as close to the holy waters as possible. Today, Wednesday, was a particularly auspicious day, which is why organizers were expecting such massive crowds. Well, that's what happened, is that there was a huge surge in a crowd just near the water's edge. And as they were trying to come out of the water, they ended up trampling on the people that were sleeping on the riverbank. I mean, it was an absolutely chaotic scene. There were emergency crews that were running in with stretchers and pulling out lifeless bodies. And at other moments, you could see other people that were just covering the bodies of others with blankets, and no one seemed to know what was going on, and there was no crowd management. People were just sort of still running through the entire area.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, I mean, what have people been telling you about, I mean, their feelings about the circumstances of it? I mean, are people sort of saying, look, there wasn't enough management of the crowds, not enough security at that point in the festival.
I have certainly heard from a lot of people that have complained about some of the organization that's happening here, that there aren't, you know, enough facilities provided for the mass number of people that have come here. Organizers, however, will say, well, look, you know, they had installed 2,700 cameras right across the city, and more than half of which were actually inside the festival grounds. And so they were monitoring everything that was happening. But obviously something fell apart somewhere along the lines. And as a result, I mean, we're reporting that there are dozens dead, but that number is surely going to rise.
Yes, I read one report suggesting that one of the main hospitals in the area, well, it's sort of been cordoned off. I mean, what does that signify? Are the authorities, I mean, obviously sensitive about what's happened here?
I would suggest that the authorities are very sensitive about what's happening here. Remember, this is a sacred religious festival. And so if the government is not able to take care of the pilgrims that have come here to perform their rituals, I mean, that's a real failing on the part of organizers and on the part of the government. And so certainly they're really trying to manage the message. And what we're ending up in a situation is we're just not getting any clear idea of anything that had happened anytime today.
And has what's happened put other pilgrims from carrying on with this ritual? I mean, judging by the noise in the background, it suggests things are going ahead as before.
I think what was really striking is that, you know, just as the police were clearing away the bodies and moving all the injured away, I mean, there was just a pile of people's leftover belongings, like shirts and shoes and jackets and backpacks strewn along the riverbank. And then you turn around and there's already thousands more people that are coming through to take the holy dip. And I think that really sort of epitomizes the situation here is that, you know, people are driven here by their faith. And, you know, because the crowds are just so enormous, it's really hard to try and say to someone, well, no, you can't come and do this, even though you've traveled perhaps for several thousand miles. I mean, remember, people have been coming from around the country to come and participate in this festival.
And that is our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reporting for us from the Kumbh Festival in northern India. Raids of undocumented migrants by the US immigration agency ICE have begun. The authorities say they're focusing at the moment on those who pose a threat to public security, in other words, people with criminal convictions. But all undocumented migrants are at risk of deportation under President Trump's policy, and some have already been picked up in the latest sweeps. Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, insists her country will only accept Mexican deportees, not those from other countries. But there are an estimated 5 million Mexicans living in the US without the right paperwork, and the country is now readying itself for the expected influx of returnees, as our Mexico correspondent Will Grant now reports.
In Chicago, President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, addressed officials from a range of government agencies before they set out on a nighttime raid. Immigration agents said they were carrying out what they called enhanced targeted operations against public safety threats, undocumented immigrants convicted of crimes, including murder and sexual abuse.
We got all of government approach. We got U.S. Marshals, we got FBI, we got ATF, we got DEA, we got ICE.
In all, around 1,000 immigration arrests were made on Sunday alone, with Mr. Holman calling it just the beginning stages. Mexico, meanwhile, has also started to prepare. In the border city of Ciudad Juarez, beneath a huge crucifix and an altar erected for a mass delivered by Pope Francis in 2016, men in work boots and baseball caps have set up a huge tarpaulin. It's the centrepiece of a tent city intended to house men and women much like themselves. Casual labourers, domestic workers, kitchen staff and farmhands, all likely to be among those sent south. Juarez is one of eight such reception centres being set up along the border.
A nuestros connacionales, a las y los mexicanos que viven en Estados Unidos.
Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has stressed the returnees will receive food, medical care and assistance in obtaining Mexican identity documents, part of a deportee support program her administration calls Mexico Embraces You. In Tijuana, troops have converted an event center called Flamingos, putting in 1,800 beds, kitchens, showers and a medical center. Monica Vega from the state governor's office is in charge of the operation. The idea is that our countrymen will be able to return to Mexico in a dignified way and to a warm embrace, she said.
Sir, this is a proclamation declaring a national emergency at the southern border of the United States.
That's a big one. A lot of big ones, huh?
Another one of President Trump's executive orders includes a rule called Remain in Mexico, by which anyone requesting asylum in the United States would have to stay in Mexico ahead of their asylum hearing. To work, the plan needs Mexico to accept it. And for now at least, President Sheinbaum has refused to agree to it.
Where we are from, no nos rajamos, and what we dream of, lo realizamos.
On the day of the migrant in December, the Sheinbaum administration released a song celebrating the Mexican migrant. We may change our location, but not our flag, the singers sang over a video of sweeping vistas of the Mexican countryside, and we were born to a legacy of greatness.
That was the BBC's Mexico correspondent, Will Grant, reporting there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Lots more to come in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. Two decades on from the final flight of Concorde, a civilian aircraft has done what that famous jet did daily and what hasn't been done since, breaking the sound barrier. A prototype passenger jet from the company Boom Technology went supersonic yesterday in a test flight over the Mojave Desert in California. So does it mean we can expect the return of super fast commercial flights anytime soon? Well, let's speak to Guy Grattan, Associate Professor of Aviation at Cranfield University and also an aeronautical engineer and test pilot. Guy, very good to have you with us here on the programme. I was just looking up, Concorde's first flight was in 1969, quite a long time ago. So why is this flight in California? Why is it significant?
It's very significant because it's actually the first time we've ever had a supersonic flight by a completely privately funded aeroplane, and it's certainly the first time we've had anything looking like a civilian airliner go supersonic. So it could well be a step into a return to supersonic air travel, at least for a few people.
It's smaller, isn't it, than a commercial jet would need to be to carry lots of passengers. So has the technology got a bit of a way to go?
It has. So the XB-1, which did its test flight yesterday, is basically a single-seat aeroplane. It's there to learn how to do it. This is leading to an aeroplane that will be about half the size of Concorde, called the Overture, and will be a bit slower than Concorde at about Mach 1.7 compared to Concorde's 2.1. But development programs work like this. You start small, you start with prototypes that let you learn a lot of the key lessons, and you work upwards, and that's the way Concorde was developed, and I think they're going about it the right way.
If it ends up being smaller than Concorde, I mean, will it make money? Because it was quite hard for Concorde to make money for the companies that bought it, wasn't it?
I think they're aiming at a bit of a different market. Concorde linked a small number of very high value places like London and New York. I think the Overture is looking more at the executive business jet market, at the parts of the airline industry, but very much more routes, point to point, and potentially a lot more routes than we ever saw Concorde fly.
And just very briefly, will it be sustainable? Because that was the other problem, wasn't it? Concorde burnt a lot of fuel.
I think that they are really going to struggle to make this sustainable. The fuel burn is going to be, depending on who you ask, anywhere between 3 and 7 times as much per passenger mile as a current airliner. The sonic boom will be an issue. The fact that it flies very high will be an issue.
So a lot to work out, Guy. We're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. Guy Grattan there of Cranfield University. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's head to Washington, D.C. now, because in under half an hour, President Trump's nominee for U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary will appear before a Senate committee as part of his confirmation process. He is, of course, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., scion of a Democratic family dynasty who's now thrown in his lot with Mr. Trump's Republican Party. And he has some controversial views that he'll no doubt be quizzed on by the committee, most notably his noisy and lucrative anti-vaccine activism, including falsely linking vaccines to autism. Views that have not have endeared him to his family. On Tuesday, his cousin Caroline wrote a letter to senators setting out why she thought he shouldn't be confirmed. She called him a predator who'd lied and cheated his way through life and pointed out that he'd vaccinated his own children. Here she is reading out the conclusion.
They deserve a knowledgeable leader who is committed to evidence and excellence. They deserve a secretary committed to advancing cutting-edge medicine to save lives, not to rejecting the advances we have already made. They deserve a stable, moral, and ethical person at the helm of this crucial agency. They deserve better than Bobby Kennedy, and so do the rest of us. I urge the Senate to reject his nomination.
However, some of his ideas do have broader support, including comments he's made linking ultra-processed industrialized foods to obesity and his criticism of the power of the big pharmaceutical companies. Neil Barsky is an American journalist and activist who became interested in those issues after overcoming type 2 diabetes by changing his diet. He's been explaining to me why, with some big reservations, he supports RFK Jr.'s nomination for health secretary.
RFK Jr. is the first national figure in America who has advocated for a sane nutrition policy, which we don't have in the United States. That means banning pharmaceutical ads on television. That means labeling food better. That means weaning children from sugary cereals. All these things that are very basic that have led to an obesity epidemic in the United States, as well as we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we rank 49th in life expectancy. So he is recognizing that our healthcare policies are a national scandal. He wants to disrupt the status quo, which is heavily controlled by the pharmaceutical and food industries. That goes down to the FDA, the NIH. These are agencies that would be under his control.
But is he willing and indeed able to take on some of those vested interests, those agencies and big pharma, big food?
He could take on those vested interests if he didn't have this horrible baggage that he brings with him in the form of being anti-science in other venues, such as his attitude towards fluoride and particularly with vaccines.
And do you think that that baggage is so overwhelming that it'll actually prevent him doing something good on obesity? And I'm sure that everybody listening will agree that obesity is a huge problem around the world.
Well, I think his first hurdle will be this confirmation hearings. I don't think it's a done deal. If he is confirmed, I do think that it will be a result of some Democratic senators probably supporting him precisely because of his nutrition advocacy. So, yes, I think he would have a shot. Now, would Donald Trump help him stand up to the pharmaceutical and food industries? That's questionable.
Yeah, that is a problem. And in fact, you know, one big drug company gave money to Donald Trump's inauguration. One of the finance chairs, I think, for the inauguration committee is a lobbyist for big pharma. Is this the administration to take on, as I say, those vested interests? Because he would be part of the administration, wouldn't he?
It would be a pleasant surprise if the Trump administration did not cave into the pharmaceutical industry, just as every other previous American president has done. So if Trump was successful in some ways, of course, I would applaud that. Keep in mind, he named him to be his health secretary. So he has committed to his candidacy. If RFK Jr. can withstand the scrutiny of the Senate hearings and be approved by the Senate, he will have an unprecedented opportunity to change the trajectory of healthcare in America and the world. His many anti-science positions could be disqualifying in a normal world. But we're not living in a normal world. We're living in a world where we have a president who feeds on chaos and divisiveness, and we have a candidate who at least possesses a glimmer of hope for helping America's healthcare.
Neil Barsky. Well, I've also been talking to Dr. Peter Lurie, president of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, a nonprofit consumer protection advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Before he headed off to a rally opposing RFK Jr.'s nomination, I asked him what was his biggest fear if he was confirmed as health secretary.
Well, aside from the non-scientific approach to decision-making, I'm very worried about vaccines. I mean, these are interventions that have saved literally millions of lives around the world. And to see them under threat here in the 21st century is just remarkable for anybody who's been involved in public health. I think there's little question that he's already undermined the public trust in vaccines. He's created a movement against vaccinations. People have listened. Vaccination rates are going down. Some of that is because of COVID, but even then, some of that is because of the anti-vaccine stance that he took during COVID. He clearly has a big megaphone, and if he gets confirmed, it's going to be even bigger.
He seems to have dialed back a bit on some of his previous positions. I mean, links between, for example, vaccines and autism. Do you trust him on that, or do you think he's just saying that to get confirmed?
He wouldn't be the first secretary nominee to dial back unpleasant or unpopular views just before a nomination hearing. So I don't put really any trust in this. Frankly, I saw him eating a hamburger on Air Force One with President Trump, and that tells me he's ready to make compromises.
Interesting, talking about food, because we heard earlier from one journalist and activist who says that RFK's message on tackling obesity, the obesity epidemic and diabetes is a good one, and it's a crucially important one at this stage. Is it possible that on something like that, which is a major public health concern in the United States, as elsewhere, that he may have some good ideas on that?
Well, ours is an organization that works primarily on food, and there are, in fact, a few ways in which we agree with him, you know, in the way that a stopped clock is right, you know, a couple of times a day. But the real problem here is when he has a good idea, it's probably one that he won't be able to enact. He's either going to run into the overall anti-regulatory approach of the Trump administration, or he's going to run into opposition from industry. So the good ideas, unfortunately, are probably unlikely to happen, but the bad ideas probably have a lot of energy behind them.
So do you think there's a good chance that he won't get confirmed? I mean, there seem to be voices on both sides of the political divide that are very worried about his appointment.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a close call. If people vote along party lines, the Republicans can afford to lose three votes. So I think it's going to be really close. There are more than enough reasons for people on the Republican side to oppose him. He's got positions on abortion that should be unpopular with them. There are people on the Republican side who suffered polio as children, who you would think would have problems with the kind of anti-vaccine positions that he takes. The question is, can the Republicans get out of lockstep? You know, most of what we've so far seen in this nomination season suggests that that will be difficult to do.
That was Dr. Peter Lurie of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Now, in Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko is claiming yet another political triumph, a whopping 87% of the vote in the latest presidential election. But it was an election in name only, with the only genuine opposition either in prison or forced to flee abroad. That's after mass protests in 2020 ended in police brutality and mass detentions. Opposition leaders in exile say that as a close ally of Vladimir Putin, Mr. Lukashenko is a danger far beyond Belarus's borders. But their mood is depressed rather than defiant these days, as Sarah Rainsford reports from Warsaw in Poland.
In 2020, this was the sound of defiance in Belarus. The free choir sang on the streets as crowds flooded out, protesting against an election rigged to keep Alexander Lukashenko in power. The choir are now in exile. But even here in Poland, they perform with red and white masks covering their faces. because the security forces back home have warned that anyone supporting the opposition, even abroad, can be prosecuted. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya doesn't hide her face. She had to flee Belarus too in 2020 after running for president against Lukashenko and claiming a win. Then came the protests, the police brutality, and the mass arrests. This election was very different.
No independent candidates, no observers, no free media, all real opponents either in prison or in exile. So it's sham.
Do you still feel now that there is a chance of democratic change? Yes. How confident do you feel that that moment will actually come?
I truly believe it was a huge shift in mentality of Belarusians. How long it will take, I don't know, but it's very important that this shift that took place in 2020, it will not disappear.
But it's hard to keep that conviction alive. That's what this entire event in Warsaw was about. Because 4 years after they tried and failed to topple a dictator, the Belarusians I've been speaking to are struggling. Яна is a vet, just out of prison after serving 3 years for joining the peaceful protests. She calculates that 1 in 10 of the inmates in her prison were there for their politics.
It was only when I could sleep again that I realized how emotionally and physically hard it had been, how I had suppressed my feelings. I barely cried in prison, but when I got out, I suddenly found I wanted to sob all the time. I thought I'd got through it okay, but I realized it had taken titanic force.
Poland is now home to huge numbers of Belarusians, driven out not by war, but by fear of interrogation, intimidation and arrest. Some opposition supporters have stayed in Belarus, like Maria, although that's not her real name. But she tells me all open activism in the country has stopped. It's just too dangerous. She used to attend court hearings for political detainees, but even that's too risky now. She could be prosecuted herself as an extremist. It is horribly frustrating, Maria says, to see the injustice and to feel so helpless. And as those forced into exile sang of a different future, back in Minsk, Alexander Lukashenko was claiming 87% support for another term as president. It's his seventh so far.
Sarah Rainsford reporting there from Warsaw in Poland. You're listening to Niza. This is James Menendez with Niza. Something uplifting now. It is a high-tech treatment for Parkinson's disease, which has been offered to patients at a hospital in the UK. It involves a brain implant, which is controlled by a tiny computer in the chest. That computer sends electrical messages that help manage patients' symptoms and improve their quality of life. Surgeons hope an adapted version of the deep brain stimulation system will have a huge impact on people living with the disease. My colleague Julian Warwick has been talking to neurosurgeon Akbar Hussain, one of the first doctors in the world to offer the new treatment, and to one of his patients, Kevin Hill.
Parkinson's affects different people in different ways, and with me it was the tremor, and it was getting worse by the week. And I was finding that I wasn't going out and socialising, I was hiding myself, I was getting withdrawn, it was affecting my mental health.
Because you'd been diagnosed, what, 5 years prior to that, I think, hadn't you?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
You'd got that gradual deterioration in your overall state of health over that.
Yeah, and I would say things just getting worse and worse as it progressed.
So when this option of the implant was put in front of you, what did you think?
I was in two minds whether to go for it or not, because it seemed to be a big operation for to go through, and it wasn't a promise of success.
And when it was turned on, what happened?
I've been cheating for years. My wife was there and they went on a computer and it was just instant. I was told beforehand that sometimes it takes a year, possibly longer, for them to calibrate it to get it right. But with me, it was instant. Absolutely amazing. I was in disbelief. So it just all just stopped, the shaking.
And it's continued like that ever since, has it?
I've had me good days and bad days, but I have more good days than I do bad days.
Akbar, tell us a bit about this device, how it's fitted, how it works.
So it's in two parts, really. The main part is the battery itself, which contains the computer chip as well. And that's a little thing it's developed from like cardiac pacemaker technology. But instead of hooking it up to wires that go to the heart, I hook it up to wires that I've implanted into the middle of the brain. So these two wires target the deep brain structures, sit underneath the skin, and then plug into the battery, which sits on this chest wall. And because it's in the right place, one of the most essential parts is getting the wires into the right place. Once it's in the right place, you can then send little pulses of energy to these deep brain structures. And the wiring or the electrical activity that is not quite working well in these different disease processes, such as Parkinson's disease or dystonia or essential tremor, we can fine-tune the stimulus in order to disrupt what we call pathological electrical activity, so we can get rid of some of their symptoms that the patient's suffering from.
I mean, Kevin talked about the instant change he felt. Is that what you would anticipate?
That is different for different people, and we do warn people that it's effective and helps about 80% of people who have the deep brain stimulation device. But there is a group of people that it might not help as well as has helped Kevin. So it does take a little bit of counselling, making sure the patients are on board. And sometimes it does take maybe 3, 4, 5 visits before we get to as good as we have got with Kevin straight away. We'll do our best to make sure we do improve a patient's quality of life enough so that they do deem it worthwhile.
Kevin, on that quality of life point, what are you able to do now that you couldn't do before?
No, I've got the confidence to go out and meet people again so I can go to the pub. I don't mind going out. I used to like to go out and ride on my bike. That's one thing I couldn't do because I was in aches and pains. I like a game of snooker, and now I can play snooker again.
Playing snooker again, lucky Kevin Hill, after having that computer put into his chest and then getting the brain implant too. Now, as Israel prepares to outlaw the main UN agency for Palestinians from tomorrow, there are fresh warnings that it could undermine critical aid delivery in Gaza. Israeli officials have now not spelled out how the new legislation will be enforced there and in the occupied West Bank. The UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, supports some 6 million Palestinians across the Middle East. Already, Israel has ordered it to close its schools and clinics, serving tens of thousands of people in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
Vast crowds of displaced people in Gaza on the move this week, returning to the north. Most remain homeless. But even before this war, the majority of Gazans were classed as refugees, cared for by the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA. Now spokeswoman Julia Tuma says it's under threat.
It would be a catastrophe. If this ban comes into place, what it will mean is that it will deepen and further the suffering of the Palestinian people who rely on the agency for their survival, for the education of their children, for their healthcare.
Recently, the Nasir family has been living in an UNRWA school turned shelter in central Gaza, as the descendants of Palestinians forced from their land when Israel was created in 1948. They've always had UNRWA food aid. Now they fear losing it, and 16-year-old Malak worries she won't be able to go back to school.
Everyone in Gaza has a specific dream and a bright future if they learn. If you ask any child what they want to be when they grow up, they'll say a doctor or an engineer. If education is stopped, then there will be no dreams for Gazan children.
Israel has long criticized UNRWA schools, saying they promote the idea of Palestinians returning to their historic homes. But tensions have risen since the 7th of October attacks. A UN investigation found that 9 UNRWA workers out of some 13,000 employed in Gaza may have joined the deadly assault and fired them. The agency insists it's impartial, but Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister Sharon Haskell claims it's a security threat.
Israel actually gave more than a year to the international community to clean out this organization from the infiltration of Hamas, but it didn't. So after a year, this was the only step, the logic step that we could do in making sure that this organization will not harm Israeli citizens.
The new laws prohibit Israeli officials from any contact with UNRWA, but there's uncertainty over exactly how they'll work. Top UN figures worry that they're coming into force just as a fragile ceasefire is taking hold in Gaza, and warn they could also have an impact on the long-term chances of peace.
And that was our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, reporting for us from Jerusalem. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, do take care. Bye-bye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.